www.healthandhumanservices.org. A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt U.S. Kids, and the Ad Council.
Well, hello again, everyone, and welcome to the Bob and Ray Show with Bob Elliott and Ray Goulding.
Suspense. It's the theater of the mind, whether your taste is comedy or mystery. We've got you totally covered here at WHFR. Check out Radio Vault Tuesdays from 10 in the morning till 1 o'clock in the afternoon. Or if you like mysteries, and who doesn't, it's WHFR Sunday Night Mysteries from 9 o'clock until midnight on Sunday nights. It happens right here on the station making waves, 89.3 WHFR.FM.
Okay, men, this is your time. Maybe you didn't choose this, but you're here now. You're going to go out there and be an all-star caregiver. It's up to you. So what are you going to do? You're going to go grocery shopping, cook, clean, be there emotionally and physically. You got to dig deeper. Drive them to physical therapy, doctor's appointments. Don't you forget about the pharmacy. I know you won't, because that's what caregivers do. Don't give up. Don't ever give up. This is your time to show the world, your family, and yourself that you're tougher than tough. Now go out there and be the best caregiver this world has ever seen. Caregiving is tougher than tough. Find the care guides you need at aarp.org/caregiving. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn. Listener-supported, non-commercial radio, featuring local and independent artists.
Welcome to the WHFR Journal, the first journal of the summer, officially. Isn't that a wonderful thing? I love saying that, and I love the season. The one thing that, to me, is sort of the paradox of the summer season here in the Metro Detroit community and probably all over the United States is the fact that we've got students that are rejoicing that they're getting out of school and getting to have all of this fun, exciting downtime. And then 2 weeks into the summer, they're bored. And they're thinking, what am I going to do with my time? Well, we've got a solution to that, one of many, I'm sure. But in a moment, we're going to be talking about that. And I want to welcome you officially to the WHFR Journal. Susan McGraw here. Last week, we started a two-part series on Juneteenth, and it was a wonderful first half of a very interesting program through Public Radio Exchange. And a little later in today's show, we're going to have the second half of that very interesting article of information about Juneteenth. So happy belated Juneteenth to all of our listeners as well. Let's jump in that summer conundrum. Well, we are happy to say that the Dearborn Public Library typically has an answer to all of that. And joining me on the Zoom line at this time is the adult services librarian at the Dearborn Public Library, the one and only Daniel Lodge. Dan, welcome back to the journal.
Oh, thank you. Always glad to join you.
Pleasure to have you here today. So we know that the summer reading program is really something that is sort of a staple in this community and has been for a long time. It just seems like it's bigger and better every year. So why don't we start there, Dan, and then we'll talk about some more of the services that are being offered for this summer season.
Yeah, we have a great number of programs for kids and adults. We're encouraging kids to take part, to keep track of what you're reading and earn wonderful prizes.
Yay. Now, we know the series officially kicked off on the 19th, but yeah, it's not too late to jump in. Of course, we're only, you know, not even wrapping up our first week yet, but we know that there will be opportunities on a weekly basis. So tell us how we can learn more, particularly if we've got a listener that doesn't have familiarity with the Dearborn Library summer reading programs.
Oh, great place to start is our website, dearbornlibrary.org. And about halfway down, I'd say through the near the fold of the page, we have a big banner, Summer Reading, and you can click on that, and you can get all the information that you need about the programs.
Great. And this is an opportunity for students to either go in full force, make an official commitment to, I'm going to do every, you know, everything. I'm going to read the certain amount. I'm going to participate. Or we can be a little more loosey-goosey because it is summer after all, and vacations and travel and all sorts of things. So we don't, it's not an all or nothing situation. Is that accurate, Dan?
Oh, yeah, by all means. We encourage people to set their goals, and maybe small, maybe large. But the important part is that you keep reading. You keep, especially with students, you keep building on what you learned during the school year and have fun, whether it's the latest manga series or Harry Potter or with adults, the latest mystery or latest James Patterson. All it's what you we want you to keep at it. Just keep at your goals.
And you make a good point talking about some of those adult selections available as well. The summer reading series programs, that's not just for kids, correct?
Oh, by all means, no. We have, I'll be talking with several well-known authors on the 27th, on this coming Tuesday. We'll be talking with Will Shelby. He's famous for writing the book End of Your Life Book Club. And he's talking about his friendship with Mr. Shelby's a gay man, and he about his friendship with a man he met in college, Navy SEAL, a lifetime friendship. But men, it seems like, especially with technology and especially men, people have a hard time, keeping friendships up. And especially the theme of the summer reading program is all together now. And just wanted to show an example of a friendship, tell of an example of a friendship. And then on Thursday, July 6th, I'll be talking with David Van Drell. He's a famous columnist with the Washington Post. He, a couple of years ago, he moved his family from Washington to Kansas City, and it turns out his neighbor is 109 years old. And they got talking, and Mr. Van Drell was so touched by his life, he wrote down as if like words of wisdom from this young man, Charlie White. One example of Charlie and his friends drove a Model T from Kansas to California in 1920. Before roads were, they're like roads or interstates. So just the fun wisdom from it. And then finally on July 11th, Tuesday, July 11th, I'll be talking with Jonathan Haig, the author of the recently well-received book biography of Martin Luther King, especially with Greenfield Village. I want to get his take on the recent Greenfield Village edition of the house that they lived in Montgomery, Alabama. Just want to get his insight and take on that and a lot of other things. It's a remarkable biography. So go ahead and encourage your listeners to go ahead and register for those programs. Just get on our events calendar, go to each date and register, see if you're online or here in our auditorium, and copies of each book will be on sale during the program.
It's amazing. It's an opportunity, Dan, that I think we rarely get in this day and age with such a virtual world we're living in, to not only have the opportunity to read a physical book, physically hold it in our hands. We love that. Kindles and things, those are good too. But for some of us, there's nothing like picking up that actual book. But then to have an opportunity to connect with the author. And each of these is very unique, all fitting the theme of the summer reading program this time around, which I think is very appropriate. But the opportunity to actually maybe even interact with or ask a question of an author that you admire and respect for the work that they're putting out there and contributing to our community is a pretty rare treat. The three that you mentioned, it looks like one of them is going to be on a Zoom connection, but we still
all
of them are on Zoom. Okay. Will we have an opportunity to join in the auditorium for participating in this in these events?
Yeah. When you talk about asking questions, certainly at the end of each conversation, we allow time for a Q&A, and people can ask questions, and I'll relay it to them with the different authors.
Very good. So the authors themselves will not be physically together, but right. We as a community have an opportunity potentially to join in. You said books will be for sale and so forth. How many people do you typically get participating in these events?
Oh, it depends, 20 to 40 people in combination of people in the auditorium and people online. And just want to encourage people to join us because these are rare opportunities.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So you have, just to clarify, we have both opportunities. You can go into the library and enjoy the camaraderie of other like-minded people that are interested in learning more. Or if you can't make it physically in, you can join electronically and still benefit certainly from these rare treats, no doubt about it.
Yeah, and you can, like you said, ask questions through Zoom on the Q&A function.
Mm-hmm. Sounds great. Some of the other components of the Dearborn Public Library system, which is, we know, vast and diverse in every way we could possibly think of. Some of the events are designed for small children, some for adults, and others for families. So I know even today, for example, we have the opportunity, this get-together Family Fridays thing, which is going on, not to mention Tech Time, which will start here in like a half an hour or so. And that's a Friday thing, too. But tell us a little bit about sort of the approach to bring families together and encourage that spirit of reading and that joy of learning new things as it relates to connecting to a library as a family dynamic.
Well, I tell you, during the Fridays, we'll have give families the opportunity to create little things that'll help out animals at the shelter. Whether it's like little toys, little rugs that cats can lay on, and everything that the families build, we'll take that over to the animal shelter and help them out. And while you're here, you can sign up for the reading program and also take a look at our collection.
Nice. Well, Dan Lodge, you always are sharing great information on what's happening with the Dearborn Library here at Dearborn Public Library. And we appreciate your time, as always, to confirm if someone is interested in participating in a couple that sound really good to me. There's like a cookbook club.
I love
next Thursday. We've got Book and Cook, Sauce Up Your Barbecue. That's next Thursday at 6:00. I could use some help in that direction. So, maybe have to hit that one. But really, so many things related to not only reading of fiction, but nonfiction and, sort of reality of, reading, as we call it these days. In addition, there's so much related to culture and community and crafting and music, which I absolutely love, some of the music things that are going on. So there really, truly is something for everyone. So how do we connect? What do we do? You mentioned the website. I understand and have experienced that it is very interactive. So kind of walk us through that.
Okay. So again, dearbornlibrary.org, and you can click on the scroll down the page and they'll have a, we have a big nice banner, summer reading program. You can click there and that'll get you onto our, what's called our Beanstack program, where you can sign up for an account. And through that account, you can keep track of your reading and set your goals and be glad to join us. On our events page, you can look for all the events we're having, whether it's concerts, book talks, everything. You can sign up there and just glad to simply give us a call if need be. It's 313-943-2330 is the main line.
Okay, 313-943-2330. Or again, that website, DearbornLibrary.org.
Yep.
It's just as simple as that, Dan. And there is just more, I think, this year than I have seen in many, many years. So we love that, again, it's expansive. The opportunities, something truly for everyone. And so we're very grateful for you, as well as all of the members of the Dearborn Public Library community, for allowing us the opportunity to continue to learn and grow when we don't even think we're learning, because, you know, school is out, but we want to keep learning, even if it's veiled. We don't tell our children,
well, we're going to go to the library.
We say we're going to go and have some fun, and then we're going to learn in the process, right?
Right.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for your time. We wish you and everyone there a wonderful summer. We look forward to seeing you, our listener, at the WHFR, banner ready approach to the library system, whether it's virtual or in person. So enjoy DearbornLibrary.org. Dan, happy summer and welcome back.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. You too, especially to your listeners.
Thank you. We've got more on the way. This is the WHFR Journal. Please stay with us. Happy summer to you as well. We're glad you're carrying us along. Remember, if you're not able to stay in the community and listen on 89.3 FM, and we hope you will, you can always take us on your vacation, on your business trip, wherever you're going, at WHFR.FM.
And this is the WHFR Journal at 89.3, and Susan will return in scant moments.
If you're 19 or older with certain underlying medical conditions such as asthma or diabetes, you can get vaccinated against pneumococcal pneumonia, a potentially serious bacterial lung disease that can disrupt your life for weeks. If you're 65 or older, it is also recommended you get vaccinated against pneumococcal pneumonia, no matter the season. Talk to your doctor about vaccination today and learn more at lung.org/protect yourself. A message from the American Lung Association in collaboration with Pfizer.
Welcome back to the WHFR Journal and happy summer. Once again, Susan McGraw here. It is my pleasure to be talking all things summer. We just wrapped up with the summer reading program with our wonderful Dearborn Public Library. And now we're going to shift gears. We're going to get you all excited about an event and then say, but you got to wait a little while. But that's okay. Mark your calendar. Literally schedule your vacations around the first weekend in August, because you and I hope, all know what's coming, and that is the Dearborn Homecoming Festival. But rather than me tell you about it, I wanted to get right to the source. No, not the mayor. We'll be hearing from him next month a little bit about homecoming. But we have on our live line the special event and outreach manager for the city of Dearborn, Ms. Erica Mara. Erica, so happy to have you here. Welcome to the WHFR Journal.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
We are kicking off the summer season, talking about events and activities. Certainly the biggest in this community is homecoming. Tell us a little bit about what I understand is the 42nd annual homecoming festival here in Dearborn.
It is one of Dearborn's biggest traditions. Coming back, homecoming is coming home back to Ford Field Park this year. It is August 4th through 6th. That is the Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, as you mentioned, the first weekend in August this year. The festival is going to be open from noon to 11 every night. Going to bring back a lot of the classics that Dearborn Homecoming is known for. All-Stars Day is coming back. Of course, we have the fireworks. We have the reunion area back, a lineup of great main stage talent that I can't share all the details for right now, but we'll be sharing more information on that in the coming weeks. Our 5K, our Dearborn Classic Car Show, a new rendition of that is coming back this year. So there's so much to look forward to coming up that first weekend in August.
Yeah, Sounds tremendous. You mentioned homecoming is coming back home, coming back to Ford Field. Can you give, for those people that maybe don't know the story about why we say homecoming is coming home, it's always been in Dearborn, but last year was a bit of an anomaly. Tell us a little bit about that story.
Yes. So last year, due to some logjam and flooding issues that we had down in Ford Field Park, homecoming in its first year back since post-pandemic times, or after the heyday of the pandemic, some might say, was moved to the Ford Community and Performing Arts Center for 1 year, tested out a new location just to make sure we could have a safe and healthy homecoming. We will be moving it back this year. It's part of the Mayor's Peace Park grant. We have allocated $750K to logjam mitigation that our DPW branch has been working on tirelessly for the past year. We feel like we've made a lot of progress in that area and that we can safely move back to Ford Field Park, and we're very excited to do so. People have spoken, we listen to a lot of feedback, so we are happy to bring it back to the traditional location this year.
Nice. And it really is where the memories have been made, you know, putting it that way, but, you know, putting it mildly, I suppose. Homecoming.
Up on that hill.
Yeah. Up on that hill. Those fireworks on that hill. That's true. It really is an institution in our community. Even our own radio station, WHFR, we're 38 years old this year. And I think for 37 of those 38 years, we have had a presence at homecoming as a community radio station, community partner, of course, because we recognize the relevance to, you know, speaking to the heart of the community. That's what we're all about. We know that's what the city of Dearborn is all about. And truly, this event was kind of born out of that concept of bringing people back that have been in the community in the past or have their roots in the city of Dearborn. So tell us a little bit about the history, if you could.
So Dearborn Homecoming is a really cool opportunity to, one, try new things, do something exciting for the community, push it into some progressive times, have new activities, work with technology, do things like that. And we have a couple cool installations that we're working on this year. But as you mentioned, it has this huge historical significance, working with different partners, nonprofits, organizations in the area, and having an opportunity to give them exposure, opportunities to fundraise. So we are once again looking forward to doing that. We're working with a lot of nonprofits in the area, whether that be through food and beverage sales, through activities at the festival. A lot of those traditions will be coming back, and of course we'll maintain being just permanent fixtures in the homecoming festival. So again, it is this really cool opportunity to mix kind of a fun progressive festival with just something that has these really awesome and deep-rooted ties to the community as well. As someone that grew up in Dearborn, I also have a ton of those memories growing up, going to homecoming every year. So it is a big honor for me to try and to carry on that tradition and to kind of work out that balance as we move forward into the coming years of the festival.
I can't imagine. Last year you were involved in a contractual way, as I understand, with the festival, kind of came in late. But this year it's your baby, huh? So
there's
a lot riding on this year. No pressure, Erica, but.
Oh, no, not at all. Just, you know, one of the city's biggest traditions. But no, I really take it in stride. It is an honor. We have been working, and our team has been working tirelessly for the last few months trying to get this together and make it one of the biggest and best festivals yet. So I got to give it up to the team as well.
Oh, absolutely. I can't do this one alone, no doubt about it. You mentioned some of the special events. Yeah. And yes, I realize today is literally, let's see, as June 23rd, we have officially 2 days, and I'm trying to think of the hours, but we're about 2.5 days into summer. Let's just put it that way, as of right now. And who's counting? I am. But we know that things get busy, things get hectic. I have literally had experiences where I've been in town, but for whatever reason, forgotten about some event or something, and then you hear people talk about it, and it's like, oh, I can't believe I missed that. You know, if you're in Dearborn, you kind of can't miss it because you hear the fireworks on Saturday night, and it's like, oh, it's the homecoming festival. But we want to avoid anybody saying, I wished I would have been in town that first weekend in August, because this is going to be big, and it's going to be great. But it's not to say that it is so overwhelming that our seniors can't participate, and I want to circle back to the special All-Stars event. That is just a heartwarming activity that we've had the pleasure of enjoying for many years also. So yes, it's a festival, but it's also really that sort of community foundational, bringing people of all ages and all sectors in. So can you speak to those sort of the youngest of the young, the oldest of the old, and then our special all-stars as to what's available for people that maybe need a little support?
Absolutely. So I can start with All-Stars Day. It is returning to Homecoming in 2023. It's being presented by Dearborn Specials, which is out of our Parks and Recs department. It is a free event catered to adults and children with special needs, and there's a lot of fun stuff going on. It is occurring Friday, August 4th from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m., so the bulk of that time occurs before festival doors are open to the public. So it is a kind of sensory-friendly time for people with special needs and our residents and greater community members with special needs to come and enjoy Homecoming for what it is. So there's going to be music, there's going to be face painting, games, activities, special access to carnival rides. And again, that's from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. the Friday of the festival. And we do ask that people pre-register, and all of the information regarding All-Stars Day can be found on DearbornHomecoming.com. In regards to people of all ages, we have a number of activities starting. Of course, anyone can participate in the carnival, but starting with the carnival will be coming back. Pre-sale information for discounted wristbands will be available soon, and that will be linked on our website as well. Look for that in the next couple of weeks, too. We have a kids' tent this year, which will have a full 3 days of programming from 1 to 5 each day, and that will include a number of different demonstrations, entertainment, including magicians, including fossil demonstrations, author readings. We've got a lot going on. And again, that schedule will be coming out soon at DearbornHomecoming.com as well. Entertainment will be coming back. We'll have two stages of entertainment. One will be our main stage that will house a couple of really exciting national acts that we are excited to bring to Homecoming this year. Again, hopefully we'll share more information on that soon, as well as our cultural pavilion stage, which will house a lot more local talent. And those will be activated on and off throughout the festival each day as well. Our Dearborn Classic Car Show, appealing to older audiences or those that can drive. All can view, but specifically those that can drive to participate. Our Dearborn Classic will be coming back this year. It is a different rendition of the former car cruise that used to be a part of Homecoming in years past. All cars, if you're 1995 or older, are welcome to apply. There is a $20 registration fee. Again, we do ask that people register in advance online at DearbornHomecoming.com. But we'll house a wide variety of classic cars. We'll have music. We'll have awards. All of our participants will get a $5 food voucher towards a meal at the Cultural Pavilion. So there's a lot going on with that as well. And that will be Friday from 3 to 8 p.m. It'll end right before our headliner on the main stage on Friday night.
Oh, awesome. Erica, is the classic car event going to be, as I recall in the past years, kind of parading through any components of the festival, or is it kind of just for safety purposes, you know, how do you have that coordinated? Just curious.
Yeah, so less of a cruise this year. In the past, I believe it started at the library, and forgive me, this is wasn't here in years past, but to my knowledge, it started at the library and cruised all the way down to the festival. Right. It'll be less of a cruise this year. They will be heading down the hill onto the festival grounds to participate. So that's as cruisy as you kind of get there. It's going to be more of a standalone show this year, if that makes sense.
Nice. Yeah, I hear many people say that they can really get up close and personal with the cars that way, too. And certainly the classic car shows are very popular. So that's why it goes from 3 to 8 instead of 3 to 4. Makes perfect sense.
And I don't want to
a lot of laughs. Yeah.
I'm sorry. I don't want to leave out our art tent, too. We've got a lot of cool programming going on in our arts district this year, including the DIA is going to be there. Working on different demonstrations and working on different crafts and activities with kids and adults. Green Brain Comics will be there doing illustration demos, and they'll have free comics. We'll do our paint out in the park activity will be occurring again this year. And then we also have our vendor village, which is kind of a new installation at Dearborn Homecoming in 2023. It's a community and artisan market that we're bringing to the festival. So that'll host different tents and demonstrations by nonprofits, local businesses, artisans and makers from the greater Dearborn area. So we're excited to bring that to the festival as well. And that's something that can be enjoyed by all ages too.
Erica Mara, you are filled with great information about the Homecoming Festival taking place this August, this first weekend in August 4th through 6th. And Erica should know she is the special event and outreach manager for the city of Dearborn and this wonderful new administration. One area, what about parking? What are we thinking for parking? I understand there's a smart app that might be a good idea to start looking into. What do you say for people that are like, I can't do it? And also, of course, we've got those golf carts that are available to drive people that need special access up there. But tell us a little bit about the logistics like that.
Absolutely. So we do have parking available on site. It will be $10 per car. Handicap parking will be free, and that'll be located on the south or carnival end of the festival, if you will. We also, thanks to smart transportation, we will be offering two shuttles, one from the west end and one from the east end, to get to the festival, and they are free of charge. The west end shuttle will be located, pickup is at Dearborn High School, and then the east end, the pickup is located at Dearborn Fresh Supermarket. And we'll share more information about specific pickup times, schedules, how late they run, again, on DearbornHomecoming.com in the near future.
Great. So really today, we just want to whet your appetite, basically, and let you know what's coming so that you can be here for this, right? WHFR, so excited to participate again and be part of this wonderful Homecoming Festival. One of many people's, I can't speak for all, but I can speak for my family, at least, and my WHFR family, Erica, one of our favorite things to do at Homecoming, and we've just got a couple minutes left here, is eat, to be frank. So what can we expect food-wise? Are we going to, if we come with an empty belly, are we going to be able to fill that up?
Oh, absolutely. So per tradition, we have our cultural pavilion back this year with our Polish and Arab vendors serving some very delicious traditional food. And then at the festival this year, we also have a food truck corridor that'll house about 10 to 11 food trucks of all different varieties where you can grab a bite to eat at the festival as well.
Nice. Well, it sounds like it is going to just take care of everything that I'm thinking. Check this off the box, you know, check this box. And it sounds like you've thought of everything. Yeah. So we appreciate that very much. And we're so grateful for your time today. Again, we are just kicking into the summer season, and we don't want to say that Homecoming ends the summer season because it really doesn't, but it is the sort of the culmination of, you know, build, and then here it is. And then of course, as you mentioned early on, those fireworks, both Saturday night and Sunday night, they are truly an institution here in Dearborn. Final thoughts, Erica, as we wrap up?
You know, we just really encourage everyone to come out. Homecoming's coming home, and we really want you to be there, experience all we have to offer, the new and the old. And we look forward to this continuing to being a Dearborn installation for many years to come. But thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
And by the way, if you're a graduate of Dearborn School, remember those wonderful, wonderful reunions. Check with your local school, and I'm sure there'll be information on the website as well about any specific reunion tents and things. That's always a big thing. So Erica Mara, Special Event and Outreach Manager for the City of Dearborn, today speaking about the upcoming Dearborn Homecoming Festival. We will be meeting with the mayor later, probably the week before the event, to get his take and his perspective on Homecoming. But until then, you know what's coming, and we hope you'll mark your calendar. Thank you so much, Erica, for your time. Have a great summer. We'll see you in August. Right. We've got more on the way. This is the WHFR Journal. Please stay with us.
And this is indeed the WHFR Journal. And coming up next, we will have part two of our Juneteenth special in just a moment.
It's 4 a.m., Monday, and you're literally sucking baby snot through a tube because she's congested. Man, that's love. And if you love her that much, love her enough to make sure she's buckled in the right car seat. To make sure your child's in the right seat for their age and size, visit nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Show them you love them. Keep them safe. Visit nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
It's Living on Earth. I'm Steve Kerwood. Writing in the journal Climate, researchers found that during heat waves, red line neighborhoods can be as much as 10 degrees hotter than other districts in the same city.
Our body is trying to cool down, so our body uses sweat to be able to cool itself down. And not a medical doctor, though, in collaboration with them, I've learned that this sweating process really helps us cool down. Though if the ambient temperature is hotter than 98.6, and if the humidity levels are high, we could reach this threshold called wet bulb temperatures. That's WETBULB temperatures, which are a point at which our body is unable to kind of cope and cool down. And so that stress that the body faces goes right into the womb that an unborn child is in. And that's a level of stress that's part of that pregnant mother and that then affects the child. The effects of redlining then can really play out in terms of what the environmental conditions are that a person, let's say in this case, a black woman, is exposed to, and that can lead to long-term consequences on their ability to manage their own as well as their children's health.
Wow, it's just shocking, really, how a racist policy from almost a century ago is persisting in so many different ways and has such long-term health impacts on people that had nothing to do with that back then.
Right, right. And, you know, in public health, it's a very common phrase now to be talking about your zip code is more important than your genetic code. And I've heard that said by a lot of very impassioned and very committed public health staff in various agencies and community health workers, et cetera. And what occurs to me is that the fact that your zip code is so important for your health and well-being has a lot to do with how we're going about planning our places and planning our cities. And that's really what a lot of this work kind of comes back to, is how did this policy really underscore the racial underpinnings of the country?
So for somebody that's listening right now and nodding their head saying, yeah, you know what, it is hotter where I live than where I work. Maybe I'm living in one of these communities that's suffering from these racist practices. What can you say to those people?
Part of my job is to study cities. And I've heard a lot about people really pointing and blaming and saying, you know, I wish people in that neighborhood would take better care of their place, or I wish they would be more engaged, or I wish they would be doing things differently. And there's a lot of this that I hear from communities that I talk to about blaming communities of being kind of, quote, sketchy, or being, quote, not really worth visiting. And these are things that really hit me pretty hard, because I see through studies like the one we did that this was a very systematic process that actually is no fault of the people that actually live there. And I guess that's really kind of at the core of what I'm hoping that this study will help reveal, is that these are kind of underlying challenges that have been there in a long time. And our work then in front of us is to be engaged with the planning that's happening in our backyard, with the planning that's happening all around us, and to be kind of really mindful about the fact that the decisions made today could have repercussions 20, 50, 100 years later, and to kind of go into this planning process thoughtfully and with a recognition that these historical practices are things we have to undo and things we have to center in our current work, climate or otherwise.
Portland State University professor Vivek Chandas speaking with Living on Earth's Bobby Bascom. A lot of backpackers wear special hiking boots when they are out on the trail, but not C.J. Goulding. C.J. is a program manager for the Children and Nature Network, and when he leads young folks out for a hike, C.J. himself wears basketball sneakers named after Michael Jordan. Here's an excerpt from his blog on why.
I am an African-American natural leader. That phrase is not an oxymoron, but it's also not something that you normally see in the environmental world. In the few years that I've been involved in environmental education and connecting people with outdoor spaces, there have been numerous occasions where I am the only person of color in the program, or the only African-American leader. Growing up, there was no one from my neighborhood traveling, hiking, canoeing, or spending time outdoors unless it was a part of a regimented program. But do not misunderstand the meaning behind that statement. Do not miss my point. I write neither to complain that the outdoor world is an elitist one, nor to lament the disconnect between the world I grew up in and the natural world where I now lay roots. I write to celebrate the amazing opportunity available for me and others like myself to be a bridge between the two worlds. On my feet as I write are Jordan Bred 11s, the only pair of Michael Jordan sneakers I've ever owned in my life. His sneakers are a status symbol in the neighborhood I grew up in, a memento of importance and significance. Unfortunately, for some people, they hold higher value than food, books, rent, and in some extreme cases, even the life and well-being of another individual. So it makes sense that while facilitating an outdoor youth summit at Harper's Ferry National Park in Virginia, an African-American teenage boy stopped me to ask why I was wearing these Bred 11s outdoors. I laughed. I asked him if he had seen anyone who would wear Jordans exploring the outdoors like we were. He said no. Right there, the disconnect between the two circles was evident, and as we looked around, we could see that even there at that event, we were in the minority. I've heard the rallying cry echo through the trees, affirming that the outdoors are for people of all creeds, countries, and colors. My Jordans are now falling apart, worn from adventures in places like the Grand Tetons and the Grand Canyon, hiking through the topography of Los Angeles and Arctic Village. This goes directly against how people, quote-unquote, should wear them, and what people, quote-unquote, should wear outdoors. But I wear them wherever I go, to remind me of the fact that though there are two worlds, I am a bridge, and am constantly reassured of its validity whenever I see another young leader follow the footprints of my Bread 11s into the woods.
So, CJ, what was the outdoors experience that hooked you?
Growing up as a kid, I was a wanderer, and so I'd just explore the neighborhood, the trees, any forested areas, my grandmother's backyard, spending a lot of time working in her garden and planting things and flowers and vegetables and things like that. So that's a key component of my environmental ethos.
CJ, what do you think it is that keeps Black people away from nature here in the United States?
I think white supremacy has existed to amplify the disconnect that we have had with nature. A lot of times, history of Black people and African Americans is told starting at slavery, and that's not true. Way before that, we had a connection to the land, we had a connection to each other and communities. And so oftentimes that story gets lost, and it's on purpose, because a grounding and a connection in nature amplifies and completes us and strengthens our culture. So that disconnect shows up through the way that communities of color and Black people live inside inner cities with not easy access to nature. That shows up in the way that our education doesn't include that kind of knowledge. That shows up in the way that white folks have taken over some of these industries connected to the outdoors and made them an experience that requires a lot of time and a lot of money. So that connection is always with us. But I think white supremacy has showed up in a way that wants to separate us from these life-giving qualities.
Tell me, how do you think the Jordan's Bread 11 helped you connect with folks?
I call it my stepping stone theory. And for me, the idea of connecting people to nature or connecting people to anything unfamiliar, sometimes it's like a river that's or a creek that's running by and you can't jump it immediately. You're not comfortable enough to make that large leap. And so the Jordans helped me to be that stepping stone in the middle, where I'm able to build a connection with someone and help them feel comfortable stepping into the middle because they understand that I'm there. They connect to me because I'm showing up as myself, because they understand that I know who they are and where they come from. And then they feel more comfortable stepping into that unknown, whether it's nature or anything else in terms of development and exposure that they're looking for.
So to what extent did you get pushback or question or even ridicule from white people who saw you show up in what they see as anachronistically as tennis shoes?
I think sometimes it shows up as, hey, you're not wearing the right shoes, because they think they know the correct shoes to wear outside or outdoors. And understanding that the outdoors can get too gear centric, and you really don't need right shoes. You don't need $120, $200 boots to go outside. All you need are the sneakers that are on your feet.
Well, those Jordans aren't cheap though.
Well, mine were. I got those for $4.95 at a thrift store in Alabama, so I would definitely consider that inexpensive.
So after they said, those aren't the right shoes, what did you say to them?
Oh, I don't care. I mean, I realized that I had something to teach them as much as they had to teach me, understanding that there are some cases where I need special gear and equipment, and then understanding that there are some cases where it's just marketing. And I knew that my primary purpose was, one, to stay safe, and I was doing that, but ultimately to connect with the young adults I was working with.
CJ Goulding is a program manager for the Children and Nature Network. CJ, thanks so much for taking the time with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, Farming While Black, a conversation about reconnecting with the land. That's just ahead on Living on Earth.
Funding for Living on Earth comes from you, our listeners, and United Technologies, combining a passion for science with engineering to create solutions designed for sustainability in aerospace, building industries, and food refrigeration.
It's Living on Earth. I'm Steve Curwood. Leah Penniman is an activist working toward environmental, racial, and food justice through her work at Soulfire Farm, a collective of 10 black, brown, and Jewish farmers. Their goal is to dismantle racism within the food system while reconnecting people of color to the earth. Leah has a book called Farming While Black, Soulfire Farm's Practical Guide to Liberation on the Land. In it, she describes her journey as a woman of color, reclaiming her space in the agricultural world, while providing a comprehensive guide for others who may want to follow her path. Welcome to the show, Leah.
Thanks so much for having me.
Tell me a little bit about your journey falling in love with nature and farming, and how it has led you to create your book, Farming While Black.
Well, nature was my only solace and friends growing up in a rural white town. Our family was, you know, one of the only brown families, if not the only, in the entire town. So we were subjected to a lot of harassment and assault and abuse. And so in absence of peer connection, I went to the forest and found a lot of support and love in nature. And so when I became old enough to get a summer job, I was looking for something that kept alive that connection and was able to land a position at the Food Project in Boston, Massachusetts, where we grew vegetables to serve to folks without houses, to people experiencing domestic violence. And there was something so good about that elegant simplicity of planting and harvesting and providing for the community that was the antidote I needed to all the confusion of the teenage years. So I've been farming ever since.
Now, that's interesting. A lot of people say when they connect with nature, they connect with creatures. You connected with plants, it sounds like.
Well, plants don't talk back right now. No, I feel connected to the whole ecosystem. But the plants are incredible. They have these secret lives that we can't see or even imagine. So take, for example, the trees of the forest, right? There's a underground network of mycelium that connects their roots. And they're able to pass messages and warnings. They pass sugars and minerals to each other through this underground network. And they collaborate across species, across family. And so, you know, when we tune into that, I think we learn something about what it is to be a human being and how to live in community with each other in a way that if we're not connected to nature, we sort of lose that deeper sense of who we are, who we're meant to be.
Now, your book is not only a how-to guide for folks who are interested in pursuing a path similar to yours, but it also, well, it has some history, sociology, environmental lessons all wrapped up in this package. Why did you add those additional stories and information in with your guide rather than it having it be strictly a manual?
Well, I wrote this book for my younger self. So after a few years of farming, I would go to these organic farming conferences and all the presenters were white. You know, all the books were written by white folks, mostly white men. And so I started to feel this real crisis of faith in my choice to become an organic farmer, like wondering as a brown-skinned woman whether I had any place in this movement, if I was being a race traitor and I should, you know, focus on housing issues, which are equally important, or some other issues. And so in putting together this book, I was really thinking about myself as a 16-year-old and all the other returning generation of black and brown farmers who need to see that we have a rightful place in the sustainable farming movement that isn't circumscribed by slavery, sharecropping, and land-based oppression, that we have a many, many thousand year noble history of innovation and dignity on the land. So those anthropological pieces that uplift, you know, the raised beds of the Ovambo and the terraces of Kenya and the community-supported agriculture of Dr. Watley, you know, those are to remind us that, you know, we've been doing this all along and we belong and we're standing on the shoulders of our ancestors. We're not trying to create something new right now. I mean, aside from writing it for my younger self, I'm a super nerd. And so there was something that, you know, I had heard, for example, that Cleopatra was really into worms. And so casually, I'm telling this anecdote to youth who come to our farm, right? I'm like, oh yeah, these worms, Cleopatra was into them. She was like into vermicomposting, but I wasn't super sure that that was true. And so in writing a book, you can't just write down anything you feel like writing, you know, you have to do research. And so this process of digging through the literature and finding and verifying these stories about our people just satisfied this academic itch that I had. So more importantly, though, than my personal need, we have waiting lists for our black and brown farmer training programs many years long. And so I didn't want to be a gatekeeper anymore to this really important practical knowledge or the historical and psycho-spiritual knowledge. And so putting it in a book just lets a lot more folks have access to the things we've learned in over a decade of practice at Soulfire Farm.
Wait a second. You have a waiting list of people who want to come to Soulfire Farm and learn how to do this?
Right? Contrary to popular belief, Black and brown folks do want to farm. And this was something that just surprised me because I thought I was just a weirdo out here. I was going to start this farm with my family, grow food, you know, provide it to those who need it most in the community. And that was going to be it. And I got a call our first year from this woman, Coffee Dixon in Boston, who said, you know, through tears, I just needed to hear your voice to know that it was possible for a woman like me to farm and that I wasn't crazy and that there's hope, right? And that was the first of thousands and thousands of phone calls and emails to come of folks saying, I need to learn to farm. I want to do it in a culturally relevant, safe space. I want to learn from people who look like me. And so we opened a training program and I posted on Facebook. It filled in 24 hours. So I'm opening another one. It filled. And that's just the way it's been. It seems that we have realized as a generation that we left something behind in the red clays of Georgia and we want to get it back. And so we're doing our best to respond to that call at Soulfire.
Talk to me a little bit about how access or lack of access to healthy food can have an effect on a family, especially families of color.
So we're living under a system that my mentor, Karen Washington, calls food apartheid. So in contrast to a food desert, as defined by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which is a high poverty zip code without supermarkets, right? A food apartheid is a human-created system, not a natural system like a desert. It's a system of segregation that relegates certain people to food opulence and others to scarcity. And there are consequences to that, right? We see in Black and brown communities a very high disproportionate incidence of diabetes, heart disease, obesity, cancer, even some learning disabilities and poor eyesight and mental illness can be linked to having access to hot Cheetos and Takis and blue drink, but not having access to those fresh, healthy fruits and vegetables that we really need to be healthy and also to be part of democracy, to do our civic duty. If I'm feeling sick or my body's too heavy or, you know, I'm trying to just find something to eat, I'm certainly not going to be going down to City Hall and talking about how we need fair wages for farm workers or anything like that. So food is right now a weapon in our country when it really should be a basic human right.
Talk to me about urban farming and how that can alleviate the food apartheid situations for some families.
I'm all for urban farming, and I think we actually need to do more as a society to provide the technical support through the U.S. Department of Agriculture and other agencies so that urban farmers can be taken more seriously and provide a greater benefit for their communities. Folks who are growing food in cities are meeting the USDA definition of $1,000 worth of product, are feeding their communities, are oftentimes doing that much more efficiently because there's no transportation hurdle to overcome. So I think it's really unfortunate that we don't often consider urban growers as farmers.
By the way, one of the most intriguing sections of your book, Farming While Black, Soulfire Farm's Practical Guide to Liberation on the Land, is this explanation of how you can clean up lead-contaminated soil, which you find in so many places in the urban environment. A very practical guide as to how you can use natural plants to chelate, that is, remove the lead from the soil, mm-hmm. so that it's safe to grow food there. I don't think I've seen that anywhere else.
Mm. Well, that's deeply personal for me because in the same time period when my husband Jonah and I cleaning up soils, we'd bring our newborn with us. And we didn't know anything about lead in the soils at the time. And she got lead poisoning. When we went back and tested, we found around some people's homes 11,000 ppms. Now, the safe limit is 400 parts per million. So 11,000, that's a super toxic site. And these are people's yards where children are playing. So, you know, our daughter's fine, but we started a project called Toxic Soil Busters to clean up that lead. And there's an incredible plant. It's an African origin plant called Pelargonium or scented geranium, and it's a hyperaccumulator. So you can plant it, you acidify the soil, you plant it, and it will suck the lead out and store the lead in its body. So then you can dispose of that plant in a safe place. And over months or years, depending how bad your situation is, you know, you have a healed soil. And that's so important because, you know, as Black and brown folks, as poor folks, oftentimes we don't have access to prime bottomlands soil. And so that doesn't mean actually giving up on the earth or giving up on self-sufficiency. We have to be able to restore degraded and marginal lands.
You know, sometimes the sciences, especially that love of nature and the environment and pursuing a career in those fields can seem, well,
rather taboo for people of color. Why do you think that is, and how do you think your book responds to this?
It's heartbreaking for me, though not surprising, because what it really speaks to is the depth of the inherited trauma from the centuries of slavery, sharecropping, and tenant farming, to the point where just seeing a plant or seeing the soil is going to be a triggering experience for a lot of folks. You know, look at nature for really what it is. It's the scene of the crime, right? The nature is the scene of the crime, but she's not actually the crime. The way we try to address that is, well, a couple ways. One is to, again, reach back beyond those 500 years to the 10,000 years of noble history on land and revive those stories and live into those stories. But it's also to confront the trauma head on.
In your view, what have people of color lost by not having the farm as a possible place of family refuge?
I was talking to an elder friend of mine, Donald Halfkenny, who is a civil rights veteran, and was telling me stories about his time during Freedom Summer, registering people to vote in the South. And he was saying that, you know, they all stayed on Black farms, all these activists, and they were protected. The farmers, to prevent night riders from coming and attacking the activists, would cut down trees and put barriers across the only road that got you out to these rural areas to slow down or just to impede members of the Ku Klux Klan. All the meetings, if you need your shoes fixed, you needed a meal, it was the Black farmers. And Mr. Halfkenny was saying that, you know, this was a clandestine network too, because then you'd see these same people that put you up in town the next day and they'd act like they didn't know you, because they also had to protect their own safety. And so I think about that a lot, that there really would be no civil rights movements without Black farmers.
And what do you think people of color lost when we lost contact with the land?
Certainly not all folks of color, right? Right now, about 85% of our food in this country is grown by brown-skinned people who speak Spanish, and there's a whole history to why that is. But I would say, particularly for Black folks after the Great Migration, when 6 million of us, you know, fled the racial terrorism of the South, I think we did leave behind a little piece of ourselves. And, you know, it's a belief in West African cosmology that our ancestors exist below the earth and below the waters. And by having contact with the earth, we receive their wisdom and guidance. And with the layers of pavement and steel and glass of the skyscrapers, it's harder to feel that contact. It's harder to have the generational wisdom. So my personal belief is that many of us go around with this nagging sense of emptiness that we can't quite name. And when folks come to Soulfire and get their feet back on the earth, what I hear time and again is, I'm remembering things I didn't know that I forgot. When we own lands, we also have power. We have autonomy. We have agency. When we depend on a system that hates us for our basic rights, our basic needs, we depend on a system that hates us for our food, our shelter, our meeting space, we're always in some way going to be beholden to that system. And so it limits our ability to resist. You know, folks half joking, but maybe not, are always saying, well, thank God we have Soulfire, because when Armageddon comes or when such and such, we have a place to go and there'll be food and there'll be safety.
Leah, how can farming and food be a healing and culturally restorative process for someone?
You know, so often as Black Americans, we're fed this myth that we don't have any culture. It was all lost in the transatlantic slave trade. We have no language, you know, we don't have a religion. So we just need to try to emulate the ways of Europeans. And the better we get at it, you know, the higher status we gain. And in using food and land as tools, we reconnect to a different meter stick of success and belonging. And it's one that comes from our people. I mean, for example, just the other day, we're harvesting squash that we grew ourselves. Squash seed was a gift from the Taino people to the enslaved Black people of Haiti in exchange for the seed that we brought over, hid it in our braids, which was the cow pea or the black-eyed pea. And so we took this squash seed as a gift from the native people and we grew it. And for many years, the ones who called themselves masters, you know, the French did not even allow Black people to eat this squash. We called it jumu. It was such a delicacy. It was very tasty and smooth and sweet. So it was only prepared for white folks. After the successful revolution in 1804, we celebrate, our people celebrated by making the squash, the jumu soup, and every house made some, and you go from house to house and sip it and taste all the different recipes. And that's been a tradition every January 1st.
How do you feel about organizations like yours, Soulfire Farms? How do you feel they're doing at bridging this gap between people of color and reclaiming their birthright, really?
How are we doing? I mean, I don't know if it's really for me to say, because I feel like we're in service to our ancestors and to our community. And so everything we do is because we've been asked to do it. But, you know, I can say for sure that everyone who's gone through our program has talked in some way about this being what it would feel like if we were free, about this being a calling home to not settling anymore for being less than our full selves, for this being a healing and repurposing. And we have, you know, last time we did a survey, you know, 86% of folks who graduated from our program have continued the work. So they're growing food or they're organizing for food justice. And that means the world to me, because I really want to be not so much to expand and grow up as an organization, but really more like mycelium to grow out and figure out how to feed our alumni and other folks in the community who are doing projects that meet their local needs. And, you know, I think we're starting to see that. We're starting to see that resurgence.
Leah Penniman's book is called Farming While Black, Soulfire Farms' Practical Guide to Liberation on the Land.
Thanks so much for having me.
Living on Earth is produced by the World Media Foundation. Our crew includes Naomi Ehrenberg, Bobby Bascom, Paloma Beltran, Anna Canny, Jenny Dory, Jake Feinstein, Mark Zedlender, Don Lyman, Ainsley O'Neill, Jake Rigo, Joshua Syracusa, Navara Tanujaya, and Yolanda Omar. Tom Tiger engineered our show. Allison Erstein composed our themes. You can hear us anytime at LOE.org, Apple Podcasts, and Google Podcasts, or like us, please, on our Facebook page, Living on Earth. We tweet from at Living on Earth, and you can find us on Instagram at Living on Earth Ring. I'm Steve Kerwood. Thanks for listening.
I learned from my adoptive mom. She said sometimes you just gotta hold on and know we'll get through this.
Mom, we are so high up. Hold my hand.
No, you hold my hand.
Here we go.
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care. You can't imagine the reward. Visit AdoptUSKids.org to find out more. This message is brought to you by AdoptUSKids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.
Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn. Listener-supported, non-commercial radio featuring local and independent artists.